Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to The Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it's shaped our thoughts on a new release. I'm Tasha Robinson, here this week with Scott Tobias, Rachel Handler, Keith Phipps, and behind the scenes, producer Genevieve Kosky. You may remember us from the late lamented film site The Dissolve, where one of our guiding principles was that no film exists in a vacuum and that all culture is more interesting in context. So every other week, we're getting together to look over a new release and see how it relates to a major movie from the past. Keith, why don't you tell us about this week's movie pairing?
As we're taping this, the four-film Hunger Games series is about to come to an end with Mockingjay Part 2, directed by Francis Lawrence, who took over the series from Gary Ross after 2012's series kickoff, The Hunger Games. So it seems like the right time to survey those films and look back on one of their clearest predecessors, Battle Royale. When the first of the Hunger Games novels came out in 2008, author Suzanne Collins took plenty of flack for the similarities between her story and Japanese author Koshun Takami's 1999 novel, Battle Royale. And the two stories do start in a similar way, with high school students pitted against each other in a winner-takes-all death match for the entertainment of a corrupt and oppressive society that punishes them publicly to keep the population in line. Tasha, do you want to lay out what we'll be talking about?
Well, in the first half of this week's discussion, we'll look at our comparison points between the films, what they have to say about politics and society, and what touchstones might have inspired them both. In the second half of the discussion, we'll take a deeper dive into how the films deal with violence and trauma, and we'll look at their cultural impact. And finally, we'll end with Your Next Picture Show, where we discuss some of our recent film-related experiences that should be on your radar. So grab whatever weapons you can carry and stay out of the forbidden zones as we volunteer ourselves as tribute in this discussion of Teens Against Teens dystopia films and where they've taken us over the last 15 years. It's worth noting that Suzanne Collins has denied that she had ever heard of Battle Royale when she wrote her book The Hunger Games, and as her series continued, it staked out its own ground, especially through the series of film adaptations starring Jennifer Lawrence's unwilling figurehead and rebel leader Katniss Everdeen. Meanwhile, Battle Royale's own film adaptation, directed by Kinji Fukasaku in 2000, takes a different tack on the kids fighting kids story. The Hunger Games films, which helped launch a whole new wave of young adult novels about teenagers fighting oppressive dystopias, is ultimately about the society behind the atrocity and what it takes to bring it down. The teenager deathmatch is a gripping hook for the film series, but it's ultimately eclipsed by where the story goes afterward, and it turns away from a lot of the carnage. Battle Royale, on the other hand, spends most of its running time in the middle of the fight to the death, and it ultimately focuses on the human cost of oppression and warped societal values. The film sets us up with a little text intro explaining how society went wrong when student riots set the Japanese government against the youth movement. The result was a yearly program where high school class is randomly selected to be transported to a secret location where they must fight to the death. The kids are equipped with exploding collars that activate if they disobey, try to escape, or venture into the expanding forbidden zones, which push them towards each other. The only way to survive is to fight, and that's exactly what many of them do. Let's start with this, guys. When did you each encounter Battle Royale? Was it before or after Hunger Games? Rachel, you want to start?
So I actually took an Asian horror film class in college, and I missed the night that we were screening Battle Royale. So actually, the first time I saw it was for this podcast. So this was, I don't know, a week ago or something like that. And I was totally surprised by the similarities. I honestly hadn't read a ton about the similarities earlier. Didn't really look into it very much because I hadn't seen it. And I was really bothered by it. You know, I kept sort of remarking aloud about all the things that were so similar. And I was surprised that no one had been sort of sued or anything like that. you know, even so far as the strange relationship between the female protagonist and the man who's the head of the games, and the sort of forbidden zones and the use of the games as the way to manipulate the population. The fake out ending was very similar. I mean, it definitely bothered me.
Yeah, I saw this movie well before reading The Hunger Games. I wrote about it in 2008 for New Cult Canon, which is a column I did for the AV Club. And the similarities bothered me a little, I gotta say. I mean, we've seen a million variations on the Most Dangerous Game scenario where people hunt people. But the similarities between The Hunger Games and Battle Royale are just so specific. You know, I mean, both movies about government-mandated initiatives to throw a bunch of teenagers into a controlled environment and force them to kill each other until only one comes out alive. I mean, that's a very, very specific thing. And I know that Suzanne Collins' books have kind of a Frankenstein-like quality. I mean, she's taking a lot of different elements from a lot of different places, but it seems crazy to me that there's some sort of, like, accidental premise here that she didn't see or was aware of Battle Royale. It's just the movies are practically identical, at least in the premise.
It's worth remembering this was not a movie you could see easily in the United States for a long time. It was controversial in Japan, and it was deemed too violent to release in the U.S., particularly after the Columbine shootings. You know, was not a great time for a film about kids shooting kids in the classroom, partially, too. So it was kind of this underground thing for a while, and then I remember you loaned me your DVD, and then it sat unwatched, I think, for possibly 2 years, and I actually only watched it a couple days ago. I'm glad to finally catch up with it. I like the film quite a bit. As long as we're talking about a comparison between the two, I think the Collins books have, and subsequent films have, an advantage where I think the universe is a lot more coherent. I was a little confused as to how well known the Battle Royale was nationally here, because it seemed to be like a national event, but also the kids were like totally baffled by what they were doing there. And it also, maybe it was broadcast on local television. It was very confusing in that sense. I don't know if it was me missing something in the film or the film not doing a very good job of laying out its world. And certainly when you get in the scenes where they go to the spoiler, where they are back in off the island, looks just like Japan circa 1999. So it was a little unclear to me.
It's not just you. I mean, there is definitely a weird fuzziness there, where at the beginning of the movie, you see this like crush of press that's like really excited to report on the end of the latest Hunger Games. Oops, I'm sorry, Battle Royale. And, you know, and they're all focusing on the survivor. And it seems like, you know, that person who is a little girl who seems to be insane now is like going to be a celebrity. But then when this Battle Royale ends, it's like there's no press, there's no sense of them. They obviously haven't taken the survivor and paraded him anywhere. So yeah, it's a weirdly inconsistent story, almost as though all of this is meant to be sort of symbolic instead of literal. But it is kind of funny, though, because, I mean, Suzanne Collins' books met the same thing. Like, people were complaining constantly. And we complained, I think you brought that up in your film review of the first Hunger Games, Scott, is just the sense to which the society doesn't really make a whole lot of sense in terms of how it fits together. And I think it makes more sense as the film series continues and the focus is taken off the Hunger Games and sort of on the larger world and on like these big emotional clashes that don't really rely on specifics of society. But I think both of these stories kind of have their fuzziness as far as the details go.
I think we can agree it all makes more sense than Quidditch, though.
Yeah.
How dare you.
I saw this movie like fairly early on, but certainly before I saw the Hunger Games, and the comparisons did not bother me until this time going back and rewatching, because there were a lot of details that had escaped me, like the stuff that you brought up, Rachel. But more than anything else, I think the multiple times a day they take a break to announce who's died, like, that's really specific from the Hunger Games things. Did the films help like diversify that for you guys? I mean, the filmmaking is so different stylistically, the acting is so different stylistically between the Hunger Games films and Battle Royale. Do you think that helps distinguish the stories, even though they're so similar?
I think it's worth pointing out, we should probably not, I mean, at some point you had to kind of not get too hung up on similarities, because everyone borrows everything. And, you know, I like Led Zeppelin, even though they ripped off so much. And it's kind of the same situation where, like, okay, you kind of took this and made it your own thing, or you didn't. It was parallel thinking. Who am I to say? But yeah, they are very different in that sense. I mean, it is, there's a lot more elements of YA fiction to the Hunger Games films than this. This seems like more of it's very much a teenage story, which I think we're going to talk about a little bit later, but it also seems very much sort of an action horror in a way, kind of genre hybrid, more and less more of sort of like the YA plucky heroine, not to simplify it too much, but plucky heroine over through virtue overcomes an oppressive situation kind of story.
I think, and I really do actually think there's plenty of thematic separation and, you know, plenty of distinctions to be made between the two movies. I mean, I kind of gripe about the premise, but I think Battle Royale is really, you know, kind of a punk statement about the oppressiveness of adults, you know, and the Hunger Games is sort of riffs on totalitarian systems and how they work throughout history. I think there's a lot of differences, critical differences between the two projects. They just start at the same place.
I forget who, I wish I could remember. Someone described the Hunger Games series politics going from Occupy to Tea Party over the course of three books. Because it does. I'm not sure. Yeah, they do get kind of less coherent politically as they go along.
Rachel, you're the one that seems most bugged by the comparison. Like, I mean, did it completely get in the way of your enjoying Battle Royale? Like, did you appreciate it as a film?
I did appreciate it as a film, but I think overall, I thought it was sort of a ridiculous movie. Like, I think I went into it expecting it to be like this really intense horror film. And I think that my expectations kind of ruined it for me a little bit because it was very silly. You know, it was very sort of self-aware, I hope. And like the dialogue was absurd and it was so much overacting. And, you know, it wasn't as sort of this gore fest that I expected it to be.
I mean, that kind of like big, expressive shouting and gesturing acting is something I've actually seen in a lot of Japanese cinema, including stuff that I think of as like pre-camp and that feels like it shouldn't fit into any kind of self-awareness thing. Kurosawa movies. That uh-huh. That really bugged me when I started watching Kurosawa, like as a young student of film. And my understanding is that it comes out of no theater. It comes out mm-hmm. of like Japanese theater tradition, is this idea of the acting being so big and expressive. In the same way that American cinema was like so influenced by kind of the mugging and gesturing of the silent era for so many decades.
Right.
Like you can see sort of the roots of that in the stylized acting mm-hmm. that we got in like the 30s, pretty much up to the 40s. So like it is something that bugs me, but I don't think it's necessarily where meant to be comic here. Mm-hmm. But I agree with you that it does sometimes
it
feel comic.
Yeah, it reads a little bit. And then I sort of in the middle, I was like, oh, maybe it's sort of a commentary on itself a little bit. And then that kind of distracted me. I think overall all of my expectations, including, you know, how much is this like the Hunger Games? What is this going to be like Audition, or is it going to be, you know, like Lady? That sort of ruined it for me a little bit, I think.
I mean, for me, I look back to touchstones like Stephen King's novella, The Long Walk, or I mean, to some degree, it feels like Survivor. It feels like The Running Man. You know, there are a lot of other survival stories. Suzanne Collins herself says that like her biggest touchstone was like the story of Theseus and the Minotaur, where like Greek society, like they were forced to sacrifice seven beautiful young men and seven beautiful young women every year to the Minotaur. And so there was this idea of like society giving up its best and brightest, which is something that you find in a bunch of different myth cycles, which I find sort of interesting, but that really doesn't explain some of the specifics.
Those are all public domain things, society's influences too.
Yeah, but I also sort of go back to, you know, when J.K. Rowling came out with Harry Potter, a lot of people said, oh, so you've got like a dark-haired boy wizard with scarred face and a Pat Owl who's, you know, this like kind of lonely chosen one kid who's got more power than anybody else. So he's basically Neil Gaiman's Tim Hunter. And Neil Gaiman immediately said, yeah, we draw on the same myths, guys. Get over it. So I don't know. I'm with you on this, Scott. I think It's a really difficult like line to walk, because you don't want to give somebody a pass for stealing somebody else's story, but you also don't want to say, all right, I wrote a story about a guy, now nobody else can write a story about a guy.
Right.
Like, where do you draw the line?
I'm just going to acknowledge the similarities and move on myself, but they're there. They bug me a little bit, but it's time. But I think there's a lot more to talk about with the Hunger Games and a lot of different things to talk about between the two films. I don't think there are plenty of ways where there's some separation.
Well, one of them is that the tonal thing that Rachel mentioned. I'm curious what you guys think about the like the comic or camp elements. Like, do you think that this movie is meant to be deliberately camp or comic?
I think it's, you know, kind of meant to be exaggerated, but I mean, I don't know. I just kind of like accepted this was the style it's going to be and kind of went with it. You know, it's just sort of a little mental adjustment you do. And that's, you know, I don't necessarily expect methody performances from these actors.
Oh, I don't mean, does it bug you? I mean, like, did you laugh or did you there are points, especially when people are like declaring their eternal love in an operatic style. Like I have been shot 47 times, but I'm still going to have time to deliver one speech before I die.
It struck me as operatic black comedy, and I appreciate it as such.
Yeah.
Oh, it's completely set up that way too. I mean, my favorite scene in the whole movie, my favorite sequence of the whole movie is before they're. Before they go out there, and it's Takeshi Kitano, and he's got the silly video, and he's just kind of introducing the whole thing to them, and it's a tense scene, and there are actually some kids who die in the scene, but I think it really establishes the tone of the film, which is violent and dark and funny, and it kind of carries on from there, and I mean it just little touches like the weapons that they're given. I mean, what our hero has, like a pot lid, you know. I mean, it's clever.
Yeah.
And you know, I really enjoyed scenes like, you know, these you get, the movie has a great sense of social dynamics, of teen social dynamics, and there's a scene with them one in the lighthouse, these girls in the lighthouse, and they form this alliance, and it just goes completely south, you know. And I think it's full of clever things like that. So I think there's a lot of really of tongue in cheek elements. I think you are supposed to take it as a sort of a dark entertainment, and not a, you know, a mm-hmm. serious indictment of anything. If anything, it's a playful take on the theme of generational resentment, really.
I think the fact that you bring up Beat Takashi in there, like we've got to talk about his presence in this film, because it's kind of amazing. Like all of the Beat Takashi films, and he's both an actor and a writer director, so he's scripted a lot of stuff for himself that he starred in, but he's also like a fairly well known like both filmmaker and actor in Japan,
and also talk show host.
Oh,
is he? He was also a comedian as well. So I mean he became famous outside Japan for these violent movies, including the wonderfully named Violent Cop. It's about a violent cop. But before that, he was like a TV comedian star, visual artist, and you know, talk show host and everything.
That's amazing. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. He's a major public figure. People recognize him. And the movie plays on that. I mean, they use his real name, right?
Yeah.
They call him Kitano in the movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he was apparently told just to play himself. And he,
really? And, yeah, that's himself. Yeah. That, oof.
Because
this is a persona. That's sort of the point I was going to make. Is this is a persona we've seen over and over in his films? Is like he scripts himself a lot of like tremendous badasses with like gangster backgrounds and like people who everybody is afraid of, but who also has this sort of like soulful sad sack thing going on, and that's exactly what he's playing here.
The thing I like about his character here is that he's just set up from the beginning. It's just so pathetic, you know. I mean, here's a teacher who couldn't really handle the students and kind of developed this resentment, and now it's all being played out on this really excessive scale. And I think he's kind of reduced to being very small by the end of the movie.
I mean, he's literally stabbed in the butt.
He steals cookies.
Why is there such a theme in this movie of butt stabbing? Like he stabs a different student in the butt,
right?
Like as vengeance for himself getting stabbed in the butt.
I remember when the movie started, I was like, did he just get stabbed in the butt? I think that's when I just sort of got.
If you want to get stabbed anywhere, I think that's
a good place.
You want to get stabbed?
I agree. Yeah. It seems pretty harmless.
We're dealing out butt stabbings for everybody before we leave here tonight. Yeah, I didn't think that he came across as a pathetic figure until he takes that phone call from his daughter. Because early on, it seemed to me that he comes across as a petulant figure with way too much power. And I mean, he's got some of the same like emotional resentment as these kids do. It's just that he also has the power to kill them all as punishment for it, which kind of speaks to your point about adults abusing their power mm-hmm. and their privilege.
Well, I mean, it's almost a potato thing for me in terms of petulance and being pathetic. So I think
because they're all P words.
Yeah, that is the.
I say potato. You say petulance. Well, all right, Scott, you're our reigning expert on Japanese extreme cinema,
yes.
Given your deep-seated love of Takashi Miike and The Audition and all of those films where people get mutilated. How does this fit into extreme cinema for you?
It doesn't. Wow, that's an unexciting twist.
Boom.
Everybody,
he drops the mic.
It does not fit at all. It certainly doesn't fit into like the J horror of people like Takashi Miike. Battle Royale was the last film by Fukasaku, who was quite old when he made it, around 70 or so, I guess. He was a genre filmmaker. He was making movies in the late 60s, early 70s. Made a bunch of like kind of you know, crime movies. Like, well, there's a famous one called Battles Without Honor and Humanity. But he also spent a stretch of his career in the late 60s and early 70s making movies hailing the rebel youths of Japan. I've seen a couple of them. One called Blackmail Is My Life. Another one called If You Are Young, Rage, which I think is probably a horrendous translation of something that isn't quite so dopey. But both of those films were sort of charged with, you know, an excitement over, you know, the forward-thinking cinema of Jean-Luc Godard and over kids who just break the rules. I mean, that he's on their side. And so this is, so Battle Royale is 100% a continuation of that attitude that he had, you know, 30 years earlier. And so I really think it has no relation to the trends of the day, other than maybe he could amplify the violence and get away with it.
I guess, I mean, my understanding is that the novel was kind of meant to tap into this deep-seated concern in Japan at the time about, like, youth violence and the concern that every generation ever has had that, you know, kids these days are just too disrespectful and they're causing the downfall of society. This just kind of ramped it up to a higher level.
Yeah. And in those early films that I talked about, absolutely the same thing. I mean, it's really the same thing for every, as you say, every generation has that feeling that of resenting the kids. And this is the same thing, but 30 years later.
Do you guys, are there any particular touchstones that hit home for you in terms of like youth and revolt films or, you know, oppressive adult versus the youth relationships?
I thought it was a little bit, I mean, again, I've taken one Asian horror film class in college. I'm not an expert like you, Scott, but I thought it sort of fit in terms of like being sort of narratively all over the place and a little bit sort of muddled, and the fact that it just sort of goes there. That to me felt very much like the Japanese horror films that I'd seen.
I mean, it may be a stretch, but there's probably a direct line to be drawn between, you know, this and something like Lindsay Anderson's If, which is ends in violence, but it's also very much a film in which the kids are constantly oppressed by, you know, hypocritical adults who don't have their best interests in mind, who are just kind of taking advantage of them, or at worst, just kind of ignoring them and looking after themselves. So, you know, and that would be an interesting double feature. I'd watch those two movies together.
Yeah, and I think another connection to If, too, is that to the degree to which it's abstracted. I mean, it's not as abstracted, like if we'll just cut to, you know, fantasy sequences and that sort of thing, or some things that seem like they're real, but they're not, or something. But I think that we can at least take Battle Royale as just some grand metaphor rather than something that, you know, is literally happening. The action of the film anyway.
If also, as I recall, like, has a pretty confrontational camera style. There's a lot of zooms and a lot of like pushes into the action, which you kind of have here as well. I get the feeling that if this had been made like 10 years later, a lot of it would have been handheld. Like a lot of it would have been like pushing in really, really close on the action, because there's just this kind of love of, you know, the intensity of the moment, which goes with the intensity of the acting. But I mean, let's talk a little more about just sort of the experience of like these films versus each other. I'm not hearing like the enthusiasm in this room that I heard for All the President's Men. Like, do you
it's
guys
not as
like
good as
Battle
All the President's
Royale?
Men.
I liked it quite a bit. I thought it was really entertaining all the way through. And I the narrative fuzziness aside, and the fact that there are all these characters I keep track of for it first, you know, I thought it moved along really nicely. And some of the scenes were like the set piece we were talking about of the girls, the alliance falling apart, and some of the other action scenes were really good, and some of the dark humor with the kids who spend all that time figuring out a way to blow up, and then they just it doesn't work out.
It doesn't. I love that though. That is a great that is a great moment, because it does it's building to something, and you're really excited, and then it's like, well, that's a very clever element of the film for sure.
Yeah, I enjoyed it, and the Hunger Games films too. I'm an enthusiast. I haven't seen the new one yet. I don't think any of us have.
No, none of us will have the chance to see it as we're taping this. I should just say up front, like, none of us have seen Mockingjay Part 2 yet, because it hasn't screened in Chicago and won't until 2 days before opening. So we are kind of talking more generally about the series, but the series as a whole is very different from the Hunger Games the film, and like that's something we could talk about in general as well. Is just the Hunger Games series builds in a direction that's so far away from where it starts with this like very battle royale like story. I mean, it kind of becomes a war movie. It's all about like the building of this symbol, and it's less internal than the books are about what's going on with her internally and like how much this process is breaking her and how much she doesn't want to be where she is. It necessarily, because it's a film series, becomes more about her surface and what she's portraying. But I think that's still really there. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that this is a very violent, dark movie, but I think The Hunger Games is darker. I mean, it's sort of a family film in a sense, but I think it has very little sense of humor about itself. There's nothing light about it. It's very dark and sort of relentless in that sense, which I thought was more interesting. I thought Battle Royale would be much darker.
Yeah, I mean, Battle Royale does have that the relief of being humorous and being, you know, sort of comic booky or cartoony. But I don't know. I'm a fan, first of all. I mean, I guess we've been kind of not as enthusiastic, as you say, as we were on All the President's Men, which is proper. But I do like this film. You know, I think it's fascinating as sort of a Lord of the Flies-esque demonstration of social dynamics. It's fascinating as an expression of millennial anxiety. It's also really violent, which I like. It has a kind of that live-action manga thing going. And it does have its own set of themes. You know, I don't know. There's something I was impressed by how watching 15-year-olds savagely murder other 15-year-olds was very entertaining.
it's almost like you've discovered what it's like to be watching The Hunger Games as a member of the Capitol.
Exciting. But I think the way what the film does that's sort of artful is that it follows through on that violence, which is something that Hunger Games does not do, and mm-hmm. we'll talk about that later. But it also makes it palatable, I think. Battle Royale is a fun film to watch. It's not like, for all the reluctance, I suppose, of associations with Columbine, I feel like it's abstracted enough to where you can accept it as entertainment, you can accept it as metaphor, and not be, completely horrified by it. I mean, this is not Elephant. You know, I mean, no. This is not, you don't accept it at that level. And that takes skill on the part of Fukasaku to make that happen, because I think in concept, you know, it's a little bit alarming, and I will say, you know, Hunger Games, the steps that it takes, and again we'll get to that later, much more dubious in terms of making it palatable for a mainstream audience.
I think we should probably acknowledge that there is some real darkness in the film. The character of Mitsuko, who basically becomes a slasher film villain almost within minutes of the game's beginning, you get a flashback to her sort of ugly origins as the daughter of a woman who basically tries to sell her into child pornography, and how she's kind of always dealt with the world violently in one way or another.
The director's cut.
It's actually quite a nice touch where you get a flashback sequence to Mitsuko, who, if you recall, is the one who basically just loves a killing. But where there's a scene where her mother is like this drunken woman. She comes home one day and it's like, meet your new friend. He's going to take you upstairs and take some pictures of you.
Oh my God.
And yeah, it's quite darkly played, and she ends up defeating him through violence, and I forget exactly how. And then, sort of get the feeling this is someone who's always, you know, this is just flipped a switch. So I was waiting to be flipped in her. So, I like that part. I've heard people prefer the original cut to the
and by
special
people,
edition.
We mean Scott.
Alone, but it was actually quite a good scene.
Scott, what's your objection to the director's cut?
My objection is that it's not a director's cut. Is that Fukasaki was not around for it. He died. And that they just added footage to it, but I guess maybe some interesting footage.
That was interesting, yeah. But there's also stuff that's weirdly like you see in the film, and then it's repeated in the epilogue. Were there epilogues in the version you guys saw?
No, there's pretty much so. Spoilers. They're, as you say, they're hanging out in Japan talking about what's next.
Do they have the dream sequence in the theatrical version? The dream?
No,
sequence?
There's no dream sequence. Oh,
there's some really interesting stuff then in the longer version. There's an interesting sequence where Noriko is. It's unclear whether Noriko or Kitano is having a dream, and like it kind of like. And it seems like perhaps they were dreaming it together. It's like it's just them eating, like wandering like kind of a beach landscape and eating ice cream.
Oh, no, that's
in the movie.
That's in the director's version.
That's got to be either a flashback. I mean, we can talk about that scene. I would take that to be a flashback of like the two of them hanging out, and that's why he's got the affection for her. But
I took that as well.
Oh, I thought it was a dream too.
No, in the version I saw,
it seems
or at least
surreal.
No, it was pretty clearly a dream sequence. They even one of the characters, I forget which one, even refers to it as a dream later.
Oh, yeah, she's like, I was having a dream.
Right,
yeah.
Right. But it sort of implied that they were kind of together in a dream, Neil Gaiman style. second Neil Gaiman reference this podcast. But
oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is, it's definitely shot with like sort of a fuzziness, like a Vaseline lens fuzziness to it. And I took it to be a dream because, I mean, that sequence ends with Kitano like waking up on the couch. But I thought that it was a dream, like a dream version of something that had actually happened, where the two of them had had not a creepy finger quotes relationship, but like that they'd seen each other or spoken to each other, and that he felt a kinship that explains his like his belief in her.
Yeah, that could be the
case. Yeah, that's exactly my interpretation of it. That I do remember her saying, "I had this dream," but I felt it was based on something that was real.
I would just like to point out that like Keith has us like all over barrel here. He could completely be having us on. He could just be like, "Oh yeah," and there's a scene where they build a giant snowman out of gummy bears that they find lying around, and then they all take off their clothes and put on foxtails and do a big dance, and we'd all be like, "Oh, that's fascinating! Oh, the metatextual like aspect of that, really."
I guess this would also say that there's kind of a non-randomness to this process, isn't there? I mean, these are people that know each other that he knows, right? That Kitano has had experience with,
yeah.
And they're the ones who are chosen for this. These games, which are not televised, right? I mean, we don't see any cameras.
But
the media covers it, but I don't think we actually. They're not played. It's not like Hunger Games where they're played before the cameras and people are watching at home.
No,
right, and that confused me too, because how is he the teacher and they also just randomly pick this class? And does he run it every year?
I think that was a lie. I think that was it's really unclear whether he does it every year.
Right.
But I think you were chosen randomly is a straight out lie on his part.
Okay.
And
so
I think
gullible.
That they know it's a lie, because I think there's a certain like tension there of because
right.
somebody asks
like,
him,
what a coincidence.
How did we get picked?
all these kids
how
I hated
strange.
Are here,
including
the one
that
stabbed
me
in
the
butt.
I think the moral of this, it's really important that you get the moral of this movie, which is do not stab your teacher in the butt.
I agree. I'll never do it again.
Wait, how many of your teachers did you
don't
see?
Lie,
say?
Rachel.
I can't say legally.
Keith remembers the scene from this movie where you appear and stabbed like 8 people in the butt.
To be fair, I was asleep while I was watching this film.
Okay, we're definitely veering into punchy territory. So maybe we should wrap this part of the discussion up and we'll move on to the second half of this week's conversation. We're going to launch our forum for Battle Royale, look a little more closely at the breakdown and the buildup of Katniss Everdeen, and dig into what all these movies have to say about trauma and the emotional cost of killing. That part of the conversation will be out in a few days, and you'll get to hear this.
That would be violence. my beloved violence.
So we hope you'll grab your katanas, keep your bulletproof vests handy, and join us for that.